It is 8:31. We have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, both with Eat This Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
All right.
Not a blizzard last night. It was brutal.
All right. Well, speaking of brutal, and starting out with the, it was one of your top stories last week, is overhyped and never seeming to die, but the viaduct.
Yes, the viaduct.
So
actually,
you thought it was safe.
The tunnel that would never be buried. Yeah, we got the announcement this week that Governor Gregoire and Ron Sims, King County Executive, and
those
Mayor
are folks,
Nichols.
And those are folks that whenever I hear their names, I think the word bore.
Okay. Because, and you're really going to think that now, because
exactly.
they put off making a decision on what the viaduct replacement would be, even though they had committed to making a decision by December 31st. They put off doing that because, guess what? Now Governor Gregoire wants the State Department of Transportation to study the cost of a deep bore tunnel through downtown.
Yes, the option that was overwhelmingly approved by 70% of Seattle voters in their
in their
non-binding referendum.
Clearly non-binding.
Yes, clearly non-binding. Almost 2 years ago now. But even though this is a proposal that would cost literally billions of dollars more than the already inflated costs of the two options that were left on the table by these politicians beforehand, and part of the whole idea of inflating the cost of the surface option from under $1 billion, which was the original proposal, to the $3 billion for the final proposal that they put on the table, was that it then makes options like this, which are incredibly expensive. I mean, we're talking literally over $10 billion for a deep bore tunnel. This is money that the state doesn't have, the city doesn't have, the feds certainly aren't going to have. There's no way to pay for this, but downtown business interests are so fixated with the idea of real estate development on the waterfront that they cannot get their little minds around the idea that from a transportation standpoint and from a fiscal standpoint, this would be a disastrous proposal. Even studying it is a waste of money, and it has already been soundly rejected by voters in the city of Seattle.
Well, and what the Downtown Business Association is saying, what they're saying, the Seattle Chamber of Commerce, is that, well, this isn't the tunnel we were talking about before. The tunnel we were talking about before was right along the waterfront in iffy soil, you know, right next to the seawall, et cetera. Now they're talking about a deep bore tunnel under First Avenue, which is more solid ground. But you know, it's going to be smaller. It's going to be smaller than what we've got now. The current viaduct has three lanes running in either direction. The surface option would have three lanes. It would have a bicycle lane that wouldn't be part of the tunnel project. If you built a tunnel anyway, you would have to make certain improvements to the waterfront and to the streets along the waterfront, and you'd still have to tear down the viaduct. And none of those costs, I'm sure, are going to be figured into it when they come out with a final tally for this deep bore tunnel. In addition, when they're done with it, transportation planners have pretty much said, hey, this isn't going to help traffic on Mercer Street. It's going to actually make traffic on Mercer and some other arterials. It's going to make it worse for them. So it kind of makes me wonder, don't the city planners, particularly Nichols and the City Department of Transportation, can't they get their act together? First they want to improve Mercer, then they want to turn Mercer into a little side street with cafes and sidewalks and two-way traffic. Now they're saying they want to build a tunnel that's going to make traffic even heavier on Mercer. They can't get their act together.
Well, and the problem is, of course, that they're not doing this out of transportation concerns. They're doing it out of real estate development concerns and transportation and getting people from place to place. And the concerns of Seattle voters and residents and people who work in Seattle and use these streets are secondary to the real estate speculation that's really fueling these policies.
Yeah.
I found it amusing that one of the groups pushing the new boring idea is the Discovery Institute, the people pushing intelligent design
Yes.
So, not so intelligent on this. Uh-huh. All right, moving on. Metro and snow.
Oh, yeah. King County Metro came out this week and said, gosh, you know, from the snows that just happened, we had minimal damage to the buses. They had only two buses that had any damage at all on them from collisions during the snow. And as
they
it turns out...
They had two buses that were out on the streets? Really?
All right. They only had two buses that were damaged. And it turns out the reason they only had two buses was because they didn't run buses much. When they asked them, okay, what were your extra costs from this current snow disaster, they said, our extra costs are about $1 to $1.5 million, which is pretty cheap for a snowstorm.
You know, I've got this great
cheap
budget.
For the longest snowstorm we've had in the last couple decades, you mean?
I've got this great idea for saving money on Metro and on transportation.
Uh-huh.
Don't run any buses.
Right.
It saves so much money.
And as it turns out, that's what they did. What really ticks me off is that Metro's policy has been to run these bigger buses less often. You know, and I don't really understand that, because from a city dweller standpoint, it makes much more sense for them to run smaller buses more often. And as it turns out, it's the smaller buses that can run on the city streets when there's a heavy snow.
Well, and if you go to other cities, say Vancouver, BC, that have real transportation systems, you find that that's what they do. They have very frequent service with relatively small buses, and it works great. And people are much more inclined to leave their cars at home when they know they can wait at a bus stop for 5 minutes and get a bus, as opposed to 30 minutes or half or an hour, or, mm-hmm. or maybe they won't come at all during a snowstorm and you have to walk 10 miles.
Right. I don't see how that's going to encourage more people to ride the bus.
All right. Moving on to national and this week's economic news.
Yeah. The economic news this week was pretty interesting. The Treasury gave $6 billion in aid to GMAC. That's the finance arm for General Motors. GMAC, it turns out, had gotten heavily into buying up adjustable rate mortgages, which got them into trouble. But also, when the economy tanked this year, they found that they had to tighten their credit a little bit and not give loans to people who couldn't pay them in order to buy cars. They had to actually tighten up credit a little bit, and that really heavily impact automobile sales. So GMAC applied to become a bank holding company and said, oh, we'll raise some capital so that we qualify to be a bank holding company. And the Treasury said, okay, how much are you going to raise? GMAC said, we'll raise $30 billion. And as it turns out, they haven't released the actual figures of what they raised. But even before they did finish the sale of debt to try to raise capital, the Treasury said, oh, we're not going to wait for you to tell us how much capital you've raised. We're going to make you a bank holding company anyway. And, oh, by the way, here's $6 billion for you to have. And so GMAC immediately turned around and said, great, we'll start making bad loans again. I want to read you a paragraph out of an article from the Wall Street Journal. This paragraph appears about halfway through the article, not as the lead, of course. It goes like this. GMAC said it would begin offering loans to consumers with credit scores of 621 or above. In October, the company stopped lending to anyone with a score below 700, cutting off about two-thirds to three-quarters of all potential GM customers. Now get this. The medium credit score for U.S. consumers is 723. So by setting their cutoff at 700, which is below the median credit score, the score at which half of U.S. consumers are above 723 and half are below it. So when they set their cutoff at 700, it was below the median. But even when they did that, they cut off two-thirds to three-quarters of the people who wanted to buy cars from them. So here they're saying, well, let's lower it even more, down to 621. Let's start making zero-interest loans, hooking people on credit that they and debt that they can't pay back.
Well, they did raise capital, though. They raised $7 from their cousin Lenny, and then $6 billion from the Treasury. It was very effective.
Go. See how that works?
I wish I could do that.
Yeah, I know. I would like to do that, too.
Can you give me $7 and maybe I'll put in an application?
I can give you 7 cents.
probably work. It'll probably work just fine.
Any more in the economic news?
Might work. Yeah, there was another piece of economic news this week too. The Treasury, by pledging aid to the auto industry and to GMAC, it turns out now that they have promised $10 billion more than the initial $350 billion that Congress had released of the bailout funds. The idea behind the bailout package was that Congress was going to approve the first $350 billion for Treasury to spend however it wanted, and it would hold the second $350 billion in reserve, and that the Treasury and the Bush administration would have to come to Congress and ask them to release the second half of the funds. Treasury hasn't done that, but they've already committed far more than the $350 billion that they were originally given. So as it turns out, of course, you know, what can we expect from the Bush administration? They will do what they want to do, regardless of what Congress says they can do.
All right. Well, that moves us on then to international and the situation in Gaza.
Yeah. Times of London reporting that Israel is preparing a ground invasion of Gaza. This would be a very serious escalation. Hamas, which has control of Gaza at this point, actually seems to want an invasion as a way to sort of, get out of the current stalemate by creating a situation in which Israel would face almost universal condemnation internationally, and hopefully get pressure to get some sort of a long-term resolution to the problem. Now, the problem with this, of course, is that it's almost universal condemnation because there's no condemnation coming from the United States, either Republicans or Democrats. You may remember that for another 16 agonizing days, George W. Bush is still our president. He blames Hamas for the attacks on the civilians in Gaza that have killed hundreds and hundreds of people, many of them civilians, refuses to condemn the civilian deaths. Frankly, the Democrats aren't much better. Barack Obama, from his vacation in Hawaii, has been busy monitoring the situation, but refusing to say anything negative about the attacks on civilian population of Gaza. And really, it's been like that all the way through Congress. Leaders of both parties, it's been very, very discouraging. And media coverage of this also has been really stupefyingly desperate to try and paint some sort of a way that this can be blamed on Hamas and can be blamed on the Palestinians, that they're the ones being wiped off the face of the earth.
It's interesting.
It's incredible.
The media will cover one Israeli death as if it's the end of the world, and will barely, if at all, report that when a Hamas leader is killed, as one was just yesterday, that the Israeli warplanes dropping bombs on his house and a mosque, which they also destroyed yesterday, and some other buildings nearby, also happened to kill all four of his wives and 11 of his children. I don't see that as acceptable politics. That's not an acceptable political move, to assassinate a man and his entire family like that.
Well, that's been routine for what's been happening.
And that's typical.
In Gaza and the West Bank for several years now. But the civilian death toll that's been going on with this is, again, you can't. You know, it's treating everybody with brown skin as a terrorist, basically.
Yes,
and that is something that the entire world, including many of Israel's allies in the European Union, have been very forceful in condemning. And the United States has been very, very conspicuous and very, very isolated internationally in refusing to condemn it. And the Democrats have been just as bad as the Republicans.
Mm-hmm. All right. Moving on to Iraq.
Yeah, speaking of places where the deaths of brown-skinned people don't count, 32 more people died in another suicide bombing near Baghdad today. But the reason I particularly wanted to mention this was the headline in WashingtonPost.com this morning that suicide bombing, quote, shatters the relative calm in Iraq. Now, mind you, there was a very similar suicide bombing that we were talking about with a very similar headline when we were on the air last week on this program.
Yeah, it seems we read that headline three or four times a week.
Yeah, and it's the sort of thing where, as with Iraq, with Israel-Palestine, where the routine deaths of Palestinians are part of the relative peace, and then then when an Israeli dies, then that counts as shattering the calm. But when Palestinians die on a more or less daily basis, they don't. We're seeing that same sort of reporting model now being applied to Iraq, which is no longer really a problem. We're not really in a war there. It's just occasionally these bizarre things flare up.
All right. Well, that then leaves us about half the show left for continuing our coverage from last week on the 2008 underreported stories.
Yeah, we do overhyped and underreported stories of the year each year, and we did overhyped last week. We'll run through some of the underreported stories now. This whole list and details on them are at www.eatthestate.org. But we can start with local, and a couple of political ones were at the top of the list. The state Republican Party and Republican candidates ignoring campaign finance laws. This was a huge political story that had several facets, almost none of which got any kind of media coverage, partly because the media was involved. First came the record-breaking fundraising of Dino Rossi's gubernatorial campaign, several million dollars of which was illegally coordinated with supposedly independent expenditures of the Building Industry Association of Washington and the realtors and various other conservative special interest groups. And then you had Rossi, as well as Representative Dave Reichert, as well as Attorney General Rob McKenna, the person who's supposed to be, you know, investigating all of this, receiving essentially free television commercials because their media buys during a campaign are usually cash up front. Because campaigns come and go so quickly, they're ephemeral, and because big media corporations don't want to be seen as playing favorites. But the Republican candidates for statewide office, along with Reichert, got millions of dollars worth of campaign commercials on credit, even when they didn't have the cash on hand in their campaign to pay for them, which violates campaign laws as well as usual accounting principles. And in many cases, those still have not been paid back. Two months after the campaign,
and they should be considered donations at this point.
Yeah, and corporate donations to campaigns like that are illegal under campaign finance law. And this was stuff that the Republicans knew were illegal, but they also knew that the enforcement would be toothless, and sure enough, it's still being investigated 2 months after the damage was done, and two out of those three candidates won. Only Dino Rossi lost. Also on the election, we had Harvardgate. This was the overhyped blow-up in which Darcy Berner, who was running against Reichert, was accused essentially in the minds of a lot of people of not going to Harvard or lying about having gone to Harvard because her studies are described by Harvard as concentrations rather than majors or minors. The part that was underreported about this was that this was basically a smear campaign that cost her the election. She was ahead in the polls when it came out 2 weeks before the election, and she wound up losing by 20,000 votes. It was one of the great media hatchet jobs in local political history. We had the top secret police accountability report. Do you have any memory of that?
Yeah, it was every year there's a secret police accountability report that is issued, and every year we never get the results of it. It's always kept classified, and even though this last year it was finished on May 23rd, part of the whole public oversight campaign of the Seattle Police Department, and guess what? The public doesn't really ever get to see it, and it still remains classified.
Yeah, and the city raiding neighborhood transportation fund. Do you want to talk about that?
Oh, yeah. The first Proposition 1 a couple of years ago that would have expanded not just Sound Transit, but also done major, you know, freeway construction and highway construction throughout the county, the Tri-County area, included some transportation funding for the Mercer Corridor. When that failed at the polls, well, Greg Nichols sat down with Jan Drago and said, where can we find money for the Mercer Corridor beautification project? And they started talking about raiding neighborhood transportation funds that had been passed for, you know, that people had voted on and passed for upgrading neighborhoods. Well, it turns out they haven't started to spend that money yet, but boy, they will if they can get their hands on it.
Yeah. I'm going to skip pick and choose through some of the rest of these because mm-hmm. we've got another a dozen of them and not enough
right.
time to get them all. The city is watching you. You want to talk about
our
new surveillance regime?
Yeah, Greg Nichols had appropriated $144,000 from the city budget from some other who knows where and had used it to buy a camera to put in Cal Anderson Park on Capitol Hill. Well, once that was done, he went to the city council and said, gosh, look at what I did. Give me $850,000 more to buy cameras for Hinghay Park, Occidental Park, and Victor Steinbrook Park. And the city council caved and said, oh, yes, how much can we give you? Here you go. So have fun in the city parks, folks, but you're being watched.
Yeah, and I wanted to talk a little bit about the city's approach toward the homeless. Basically, there's been a war on the homeless this past year, and it's gotten almost no media attention. Nichols essentially wanting the homeless to just go away, including the sweeps and clearings of homeless encampments, the nothing being spent on providing more shelter space, and the city council voting in July to subsidize market rate housing, but not spending a dime for low income housing or homeless mm-hmm. amelioration. We also had the port scandals. You want to talk about that?
Oh, yeah. Auditor Brian Sontag was really busy this year. He audited the port last December. Well, that set up this whole firestorm of what's going on with the construction of the third runway. Is there real fraud or isn't there? The FBI got involved and started investigating, and the port said, oh, no, our internal auditors, our accounting firm, says that there are no deficiencies in our accounting, that there is no fraud, that we haven't done anything wrong. The only problem was the auditors never looked at the construction of the third runway in their audit report. And so it was only this last December when an outside investigator, an independent group auditing the port, came back with a yes, indeed, there was fraud going on, that we got a serious scandal going.
Yeah, and the other piece of that, of course, is that for all of the talk about the audits, the Port of Seattle is only concerned the third runway. They haven't looked at the rest of the airport development. They haven't looked at the maritime development, and they certainly haven't looked at all the corporate back scratching and corruption that's been going on around the port's real estate development in recent years. So one more thing that I wanted to mention very quickly before we go to national, and that is that. Let's see which one to choose from. Oh, yes. Could you tell us perhaps what happened to the plastic grocery tax that was supposed to go into effect this week?
Yeah, no, a coalition of grocery store owners combined with the national chemical companies got together and said, we can't have this happen in one city in the United States. And they put a bunch of money together, lobbied heavily, and they got the plastic bag ban overturned. Now, the styrofoam container ban is still going to go into effect. But folks will still be able to get their trashy plastic bags that blow around in the wind and foul up waterways.
Well, and that is a relief. And speaking of the environment, transitioning over to national and international, maybe the biggest underreported story of the year, although there's a ton to choose from, and again, these are all at www.eatthestate.org. But we got a lot of really bad news on climate change this year that we didn't really hear a whole lot or do very much about.
Yeah, the worst being that researchers are starting to see evidence of methane leakage in the Arctic. There's a theory that there's quite a bit of methane stored underground in the Arctic, and as the Arctic ground thaws and Arctic ice thaws, that much of that methane is going to be burped into the air. And the problem with that is methane is a much more potent global warming chemical than carbon dioxide, and once you start methane leakage in the Arctic, being able to halt and reverse global warming becomes an almost impossible proposition, and it can speed up global warming enormously. So the fact that they're seeing evidence of that now, decades ahead of when they expected it, is alarming.
Yeah. There were a number of other underreported stories, some of which are still going on. The Bush gangs, the criminal Bush gangs' final looting spree is still underway. They're basically stripping the federal government of and the federal public lands and resources of anything that would be valuable and handing them off to their friends. In 2001, you may remember the Clintons were given a lot of grief for allegedly taking the White House silverware. They're basically taking everything nailed down to the floor right now, and our media simply could not care less, as it has not cared less over this past year, and for that matter over the past eight, about all the other criminal acts of the Bush administration, the missing emails, the fired U.S. attorneys, the corrupt administrations, yada, yada, yada. There is an end. It's coming up in 16 days. Meanwhile, there were some economics lessons this year.
Oh, yeah, there were. The biggest one, of course, is that unregulated capitalism doesn't work for you. It works against you. And in the absence of regulation, you have, ta-da, scum that rises to the top, including guys like Jack Madoff. That's economics lesson number one. Economics lesson number two is that globalization has a downside, like we anti-globalization activists have been saying all along, that no longer can an economic downturn be isolated to one country. It spreads around the world, and problems in one country reinforce problems in another, and it becomes a chain reaction mass accident. The final econ lesson for today is that you simply can't roll back the clock. It's what Ben Bernanke, Henry Paulson, and the Bush administration have been trying to do. They've been trying to set us back to 2005. You can't do that, and that is only going to make the economy worse in the long run.
Yeah, and we're just about out of time. It's just to hit some of the highlights here. You may remember we're still at a war in Iraq. Oh yeah. We are also
soon to be a civil war.
Yeah, we're soon to be in a civil war. I just want to just read some of these because we literally are out of time. But we're also in all-out war in Pakistan, which isn't being treated that way by the media. The worst war in the world isn't anywhere in the Middle East. It's in the Congo where millions of people are dying. And we had the news this year that antidepressant drugs are no better than a placebo. A British study saying basically that, they're useless. But because millions of people take those drugs in this country, and because the advertisers or the manufacturers advertise in every local national media outlet.
And those drugs are enormously profitable for them.
And they're extremely profitable. That study and many other studies that reach similar conclusions, less sweeping coverage, basically don't get covered. And many other things didn't covered. They're all at www.eatthestate.org.
So there is no escape from the bad news if the antidepressant drugs don't
there
work.
There is. They actually found that half an hour of exercise every day is far better at dealing with depression than taking a pill.
Yeah, but nobody's making money off that.
Hey, all right. Spandex manufacturers.
Events coming up. Events.
Today, if you're concerned about the Gaza bombing and potential invasion of Gaza, there is going to be a protest today against that from noon to 2 o'clock at Westlake Park, downtown Seattle, 4th and Fine Pine. Please show up for that. Also this week, on Wednesday, January 7th, 7 o'clock, or 5 o'clock rather, there's going to be a protest against the draft plan for proposed school closures. That's going to be at the Glass Palace, the headquarters for the school district south of downtown. And then one more plug, and you'll keep hearing about this. On January 20th, Inauguration Day, Eat the State is going to be having a benefit at the Comedy Underground. It'll be safe to laugh, finally, after eight long, torturous years, and we're going to have some of the city's finest comedians helping us do just that. Tickets $10 in advance at Not a Number Books, or $12 at the door. Please come help support independent media and have a great time on Inauguration Night.
Talking as we do every week with Job Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
Eat the State can be found around town in bookstores, coffee shops, cafes, and where you find other free periodicals. We're also on the web at www.eatthestate.org.